We'll hear arguments first this morning in Davis, Shirley Davis against Passman. Ms. Stasel, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. My name is Sana Stasel, appearing for the petitioner in the case this morning. The case before you today arises on writ of certiorari from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The basic question is whether a cause of action for money damages may be implied under the Fifth Amendment to redress sex discrimination in federal employment. If that question is answered in the affirmative, this Court then must determine whether respondent is nonetheless absolutely immune from suit by virtue of the speech or debate clause of the Constitution. The facts of this case are simple and stark. Petitioner was employed by respondent, then a United States congressman, for a six-month period in 1974. Despite the fact that petitioner was an able, energetic, and extremely capable secretary, as attested to by the respondent in his letter of dismissal, which appears in the appendix in this case at pages 6 and 7, respondent dismissed petitioner solely, explicitly, and expressly because he wanted a man rather than a woman to fill that position.
You mean as secretary? That's the way you describe it.
The title of the petition, of the position, Mr. Justice Blackmun, was deputy administrative assistant, but it is the functions of the job that are in question here, and no one has ever contended that the petitioner did anything other than secretarial functions. That is exactly how her job was described in the letter terminating her employment, which is the only thing we have on the record in this case. Petitioner therefore brought suit alleging...
Do you think it would make a difference if her tasks were secretarial exclusively or administrative assistant, at least in part?
It might make a difference, Mr. Justice, when we get to the question of the operation of the speech or debate clause. It should not make a difference as to whether the petitioner has a cause of action under the Fifth Amendment. Whether, however, her job functions would be so integral to the congressman's legislative functions that the employment relationship should nonetheless be covered with absolute immunity is a question which must be addressed there. Our position, however, is that there is no way that the speech or debate clause can apply to a low-level, non-policy-making clerical employee. I might say that this case arises on a 12b6 motion to dismiss so that our contentions here in the procedural posture of this case must be taken to be the ones applicable.
What was her salary? Is that in the record?
That is in the record, Mr. Justice White. Her salary was $18,000 a year.
That sounds like a little something other than a low-level clerical employee, doesn't it?
It sounds like it, Your Honor, but when one consults the report of the clerk of the House for that period in time, it's quite clear that some 75 other representatives had secretaries, personal secretaries, executive secretaries, all making that kind of salary. And indeed, there are other cases where members employed persons called secretaries who made more than the administrative assistant that they also employed.
When was this, 1970?
Four. She was employed from February through July in 1974.
The salary may be fixed by each individual member of the House and Senate without any standards. Is that not so?
That is true, Mr. Chief Justice.
In some cases, they level it off and divide the work among several people, and in other cases, they have a very high-salaried secretary. Is that...
My understanding is that they are allotted a maximum of 18 slots, which can be filled at their discretion and with salaries at their discretion.
Well, they're allotted 18 positions and X thousands of dollars, and they may spread the salaries as they wish. Is that not
correct? That is correct. Mm-hmm. Petitioner, following her termination, brought suit alleging that she had been the victim of sex discrimination in violation of the Fifth Amendment, premising jurisdiction upon 28 U.S.C. Section 1331A. The district court dismissed this case, holding that plaintiff had no private cause of action. A panel of the Fifth Circuit of Appeals reversed on that issue and then proceeded to canvass all the related constitutional issues. It held, as had the district court, that no immunity doctrine would bar this suit. Rehearing en banc was held to assess whether the doctrines of legislative immunity and political question, which I might add had been raised for the first time by the panel, were applicable to this case. The en banc court, however, did not decide that question. Rather, it decided an issue that had not been briefed before the panel, had been conceded by respondent at the panel, and had neither been raised by the respondent on rehearing nor briefed by him in that proceeding. The court held that an implied cause of action does not arise under the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, and accordingly that petitioner should have no remedy whatever to vindicate her fundamental constitutional rights. The validity of that decision is the first question for this court's determination today. For the reasons stated in our briefs to this court, this case is controlled by Bivens against six unknown named agents of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. In Bivens, this court held, first, that the petitioner had a private cause of action for damages arising directly under the Fourth Amendment. Second, that the federal right was independent from any state right that might be implicated. And third, that money damages were a remedial mechanism normally available in the federal courts. In the 7.5 years since Bivens was decided, 9 courts of appeals and countless district courts have applied Bivens to constitutional amendments other than the Fourth, and to federal officials other than narcotics agents.
Counsel, some of us were in dissent in Bivens. And do you think that blocks us in, makes us necessarily unsympathetic to your posture here?
Mr. Justice Blackmun, I'd be delighted if the dissenters in Bivens were persuaded that a cause of action should be applied under the facts of this case. I think that the rationale of the Bivens majority and the rationale of the courts that have applied Bivens in the succeeding years is sufficient to suggest that we can apply a cause of action under Bivens here. Indeed, as well, there are other factors in this case which make it perhaps a stronger case than Bivens for the implication of a cause of action for money damages under the Constitution.
You know, we do try to be individually consistent, and what I'm asking is there any escape for those of us who are in dissent in Bivens?
I would suggest one, Mr. Justice Blackmun. One of the concerns was that Congress had not expressly spoken on the question in the Fourth Amendment case. In this case, Congress has affirmatively declared in 5 U.S.C. 7151 that employees of members of Congress are not to be discriminated against. Accordingly, to the extent that this Court needs to look or wants to look, the congressional declaration in the area is apparent. As a second possibility, Mr. Justice, there was some concern by the Bivens dissenters that the federal courts would be subjected to an avalanche of cases. Indeed, there have been almost 8 years of federal litigation in this area, and no court, other than the en banc court below, has suggested that there's a problem of judicial unmanageability in this area.
Yes, but you just made reference to a number of cases in this area where the courts had gone in your favor. So there is some litigation.
There's extensive litigation in the area.
Doesn't some of your answer to Mr. Justice Blackmun cut the other way in the sense that although the statute is on the books, the general kind of hortatory statute, Congress has quite carefully considered whether it wanted to make its members subject to, say, Title VII, the way the executive branch members are, or whether it wanted to subject its members to any particular strictures in their hiring and firing, and they simply have not done it. They've considered it and rejected it.
Our argument, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, is that Congress cannot mandate no remedy for violations of constitutional rights. And indeed, in this case, it has never suggested that there should be no judicial remedy for this kind of violation. Indeed, it has not brought congressional employees under the ambit of Title VII, and it could certainly enact legislation which would so provide, and indeed even protect its own members from the possibility of personal liability, which has been done in other contexts.
Well, that proposition may be entirely sound, but it doesn't seem to me that it really makes your case a stronger one than Bivens, as you suggested to Mr. Justice Blackmun.
In Bivens, there was no congressional policy stated in the area. In this case, at most, we have a congressional hortatory statute which declares what the policy of the United States is to be. Moving along, I would suggest that the court below does stand alone in the face of this authority, and in doing so, in refusing to imply a constitutional cause of action, the en banc court did erroneously look to the criteria enumerated in Court Against Ash for implication of remedies from federal statutes. The respondent reaches the same result by a different route. He uses the proviso of Bivens that special factors might counsel hesitation in the absence of affirmative action by Congress, and argues that some 7 special factors counsel hesitation here. Each of the court criteria and each of the special factors relied upon by the respondent are addressed in our brief. None of them, either alone or in combination, justifies dismissal of petitioner's complaint in this case. We would suggest that the respondent is correct to the extent that he acknowledges that it is Bivens that controls this case. As I just mentioned in response to Mr. Justice Rehnquist, we think the court below erred in relying on Court Against Ash because those criteria are irrelevant when a constitutional right rather than a right created by a federal statute is at issue. For the reasons we have outlined, however, at pages 26 to 36 of our opening brief, application of the court criteria would require recognition of a private cause of action nonetheless on the facts of this case.
Your reliance is on the equal protection component of the Fifth Amendment?
That's correct, Mr.
Exclusively?
Yes, sir.
Is it your view that the Equal Protection Clause, even of the 14th Amendment, confers personal rights? Doesn't it just have to do with classifications?
I don't think that the analysis would be different under the Fourth Amendment as under the Fifth Amendment and the implications...
Well, there are many provisions of the Constitution, the First, the Fourth, and the Sixth Amendments, among others, that specifically and explicitly confer personal protections, freedoms, and sometimes rights. Free press, free speech, free exercise of religion. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, however, just has to do with classifications, doesn't it?
That is true, Mr. Justice White, but many classifications, or at least several, have been deemed for this court to rise to the level of being constitutionally safeguarded and thus subject to equal protection scrutiny.
They're invidiously discriminatory classifications, but there's nothing in the Equal Protection Clause that confers personal rights by contrast to those provisions of the Constitution, examples of which I gave you.
What the courts have held, however, and indeed this is the constitutional jurisprudence which has come down from Marbury against Madison, is that when constitutional rights are invaded, as opposed to other kinds of rights,
the Equal Protection Clause just requires a state in the 14th Amendment, or insofar as it's a component of the Fifth Amendment, requires the federal government to grant everybody equal protection of the laws. It doesn't confer on individuals personal rights, does it?
I believe the very purpose of the Bill of Rights...
We have a personal right of the exercise of free speech against governmental interference, or one has a personal right if brought to trial in a criminal court to the assistance of counsel and so on. Everybody has that. Each individual has that personal right. But what is there in the Equal Protection Clause that confers any such comparable personal rights?
Indeed, you're going to the heart of the case, Mr. Justice Stewart, in suggesting that constitutional rights must be implied or remedies for them from the Constitution, because without that implication of a cause of action, those rights would be reduced to meaningless rhetoric. There would be no enforcement mechanism for ensuring those guarantees.
May I ask you a question? Would your Bivens analysis be applicable to key staff personnel at the White House?
Again, I think the answer, Mr. Justice Powell, is yes, as regards the cause of action aspect of the case before you this morning. If there were to be any bar to trial on the merits, it would have to come under any official immunity which might be invoked under the rules governing immunity in that area, which are somewhat different from those at this point in time governing the operation of the speech or debate clause in the legislative context.
You think if Jody Powell were relieved, he'd have a cause of action against the president?
I'm frank to say that if he were relieved for reasons which were invidiously discriminatory, then the answer would have to be yes.
If the president had written him that he preferred to have a talented woman in his position and complimented him warmly, as Congressman Passman did, that would be fairly analogous, wouldn't it?
Yes, sir. And I think the cause of action that we're asking for this morning would be the same.
How about Pacific Tell and Tell, where the provision of the Constitution guaranteeing to each state a Republican form of government was held to be not judicially enforceable? That certainly is an example of a constitutional provision which this Court has said it's in the Constitution, but there just isn't any private right of action. Pacific Tell and Tell against Fuller, a long time ago.
Mr. Justice Frankwith, I apologize. I missed the first sentence of your
You were saying that, you can't have a right without a remedy and that sort of thing. How about the case of Pacific Telephone and Telegraph versus, I think it was Fuller, decided in about 1910, where this Court said that although the Constitution does say every state shall be guaranteed a Republican form of government, nonetheless, the people in Oregon who were challenging the referendum provision were told that cause of action, that provision simply isn't judicially enforceable.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I confess it's not a case that I'm familiar with and can't speculate upon on those facts, but I would suggest that in the context of a Bill of Rights guarantee, that Bivens would be the law of the case at this moment in time.
Certainly Bivens is a lot later than that one. Hypothetical, with the variation of Mr. Justice Powell's question. I don't know how many legislative assistants the President has, but let's assume he has five of them and they're all men. And he calls one of them five in and says, "Now you're doing splendid work. I have no complaints at all. But in this modern day, we've got to have a woman, at least one woman, handling legislative relations with Congress. And therefore, I'm sorry, but I have to replace you with a woman." Cause of action?
I think in that context, Mr. Chief Justice, other kinds of balancing factors come into play. What you were talking about there are political concerns which might govern action in this area, because indeed elected representatives have a historical and constitutional function to represent certain constituencies and to represent certain positions. In that context, we are not talking about a case of invidious discrimination, nor are we talking about a case where performance is, or job relatedness is the issue. That is quite different from a case where, based on nothing more, a member of Congress explicitly stated that only a man could fill a position that without question has stereotypically been held by women.
Well, counsel, you could say that
there would be a Fifth Amendment cause of action and still say that a cause of action hasn't been stated. Even if one has been stated, you might lose the case. You don't need to answer the Chief Justice simply. Just because the President might win the case, that there wouldn't be a cause of action available under the Fifth Amendment.
To be sure, Mr. Justice, what we are talking about at that point is trial issues and proof issues rather than a statement of a cause of action in the federal court system.
My question was exclusively, would there be a cause of action, not to whether he might win or lose it?
In that context, Mr. Chief Justice, I have to answer yes.
May I ask another question? What does Title VII provide with respect to staff personnel in the White House?
Under Title VII, members of the executive branch staff are covered. It is the judicial and legislative staffs which are not in the competitive service which are exempted from the operation of Title VII.
No exceptions with respect to White House personnel?
Not on its face,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Justice Powell.
No separation of powers problem?
Congress, in its wisdom, did not exempt those particular staff people.
Yes.
Well, and the President presumably signed the bill. Is Title VII applied to the executive branch applicable only to the competitive service, or is it applied to anyone who gets a paycheck from the federal government?
Title VII in the executive branch context applies to members of the civil service, which have been defined under the appropriate statute to mean appointees of the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. It is then when one looks to the definition of the competitive service that one finds the restriction which applies to the legislative branch.
Well, but the competitive service, I would assume, probably doesn't cover top White House employees or the Secretary of the Treasury or people like that.
They're not expressly exempt it from the operation
well,
of
but
the competitive
many
system.
Many employees of the executive branch are expressly exempted, aren't they? Is the military exempted?
The military is not exempted.
Is a cabinet officer an employee? He's certainly not. He's an officer. He's an employee.
He's appointed, however.
Well, he's not an employee. He's the opposite of an employee. He can be removed tomorrow morning if they don't want to do it this afternoon.
His commission recites that he serves at the pleasure of the president, as I think, with all presidential appointees.
In that case, Mr. Chief Justice, the question might be resolved by operation of separation of powers doctrine, which would confer a textual commitment to another branch of the federal government. That is not the case here, where there is no such textual commitment to another branch of the government, nor are there any other of the political question separation of powers kinds of formulations which can be brought to bear in the instant situation. I think it appropriate to turn to the question of speech or debate immunity at this point in time. Petitioner argues that the absolute immunity conferred by that clause does not protect the respondent here.
This wasn't decided by the en banc court, was it?
No, sir. It was not. It was only decided by the panel. This court has interpreted the parameters of the clause on 9 separate occasions. All of these are discussed in our brief. I think it appropriate to suggest that the court has, with undeviating consistency, articulated principles which have not wavered almost over 100 years. These are several. First, that the clause has finite limits. Second, that its scope is to be confined to activities which are within the legitimate legislative sphere. And third, that the speech or debate clause is not a grant of personal prerogative. Instead, its purpose is to ensure the independence of the legislative branch, and thus, as discussed a moment ago, it is indeed the ultimate guarantor of separation of powers. The court has made clear that there are many cases, many activities regularly performed by a congressman or somehow tangentially related to his performance, which are nonetheless outside the scope of the clause. It is our contention that firing a secretary whom no one has ever contended had policymaking or legislative responsibilities is outside the scope of the protection conferred by that clause. To hold otherwise would be to violate the governing principles that I enunciated above.
Paul, why would it be any worse to fire a secretary on the basis of sex discrimination than an administrative assistant who had policymaking responsibility?
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, our position is that the court need not go so far in this particular case. It's our position that under no circumstance can the speech or debate clause protect the low-level employee. There are two means of analysis that I suggest would be appropriate in devising limiting principles for the operation of the clause. One of them would be on the basis of the kind of job functions at issue, and this court has oftentimes made distinctions based on the nature of job responsibilities. A second analytical framework, indeed a broader one, which the court doesn't need to reach today, is to suggest that this kind of invidious discrimination is so egregious that under no circumstance could any employee of a congressman, and thus the congressman himself, be protected by virtue of the speech or debate clause.
This is an employee of the federal government. This is not an employee of the congressman, then. It's an employee of the federal government working in the congressman's office, correct?
The checks are issued from the House of Representatives Treasury, but the statute is clear that the member of Congress has ultimate hiring and firing responsibility
as an agent of the federal government, correct?
That's correct.
Which is the employer.
That's right. Which is exactly why this rises to a Fifth Amendment violation.
Right, right. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a Fifth Amendment case.
That's correct. Well,
under your second line of analysis, I presume that if in my annual search for law clerks, if I were to interview women and find women, a woman who felt that some of my votes in cases involving women weren't all that satisfactory to her and felt she would have some difficulty working for me for that reason, and she could prove that I didn't hire her for that reason, she would have an action against me.
I think not, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. I think that what you are suggesting falls in the nature of selection criteria for the job. It does not fall into the category of discrimination based upon sex. It's a distinction we have to make for these purposes. I know that my time has expired, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm prepared to submit this case.
Mr. Geer.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, we submit that a Bivens cause of action should not be implied from the Fifth Amendment, but that it should be limited to a Fourth Amendment search and seizure situation or physical intrusion situations. These arrest and detention or search and seizure situations are situations where the power of government and its police power is clearly an abuse upon the private citizen. In a employment situation such as we have here, it's much more like an act between two private citizens rather than an act that has a greater effect upon the citizen because it is the power of government. We submit further that in this case there are special factors which counsel hesitation in creating a cause of action. The first of those special factors is that we believe that a flood of new cases will overly burden the judiciary because the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause is broad and it apparently is getting broader. The Court is familiar that civil rights filings have risen from around 296 in 1961 to over 13,000 in 1977. They dropped a couple percent in 1978. But
how is that phrase defined in those statistics?
It's
civil rights filings.
It apparently covers employment cases. It does not cover prisoner cases, I understand, but it does cover employment cases.
I.e. under statutes like Civil Rights Act of 1964?
Yes, sir. And the director,
it's not surprising that there are more such cases after the passage of that act than there were before.
I agree with you, sir. That's correct.
And it's true. Where we taught law school, anybody can file a lawsuit.
Well, that's right.
The important thing is to win it.
That's true, sir. But we feel that if cause of action is... Excuse me, sir?
Isn't this precisely one of the arguments that Mr. Justice Black and Mr. Justice Blackmun made in dissent in Bivens?
That's correct, Your Honor. You know, we feel that the flood of new lawsuits upon federal officials will inhibit federal action and will also inhibit federal employment.
Outside of this one, how many more do you have in this flood?
Beg your pardon, sir?
Outside of this case, how many others do you have in this flood you're talking about?
Well, sir, the every circuit court has considered the Bivens-type cases, and they're moving up to you, sir.
How many? 11 circuit courts. That's 11. How many more?
Well, I don't know the exact number, sir. We're concerned that federal employment and federal decisions will be inhibited by the fear of personal judgments. Because the ordinary federal official or federal employee can't handle a personal judgment. He's going to be bankrupt. We'll have the officers of the court going and satisfying judgments out of the home of a federal official who's been the victim of some Fifth Amendment cause of action.
Mr. Geer, would the same argument apply to enforcing Section 1983 against state officials?
I think so, sir. Yes. Of course, in this case, Congress, we believe, has clearly not intended to create an act or cause of action in the federal court system against itself. Congress did exempt itself and the judiciary for the personal staff employees of congressmen and of the judiciary when it passed the Civil Rights Act amendments in 1972.
Well, the petitioner in this case is not an employee of former Congressman Passman. She was an employee of the federal government.
Well, that, of course, is the Fifth Amendment connection of the case.
Exactly right. Why wasn't the suit appropriately brought against the United States?
But congressmen I don't know that. You have to ask the plaintiff on that, sir. I really don't know. But this is one reason we feel that the exemption to the Civil Rights Act is very important, because under the Civil Rights Act, federal employees who have causes of action aren't permitted to sue the particular individual involved. They sue the government. There's no question about personal liability, as I understand it, for federal employees who are covered by the Civil Rights Act. The House of Representatives had no policy against any kind of discrimination until it passed Clause 9 of its House Rule 43 in January of 1975, 6 months after the discharge of Ms. Davis. And even then, it passed just an internal resolution prohibiting sex discrimination. So at no time, as I view it, has either House or Congress put before the judiciary a cause of action in a statute permitting the judiciary to consider cases against it on the basis of sex discrimination or Fifth Amendment problems. We have both the House and the Senate are...
Are you suggesting that there never should be a cause of action under the Fifth Amendment until and unless Congress indicates that there should be some kind of a cause of action?
I'm suggesting that there should be no cause of action against Congress until Congress suggests that, sir, because we have separation of power principles involved here, which is another of the spatial factors we believe should counsel hesitation in this case, is that we feel that if Congress were going to create a cause of action against itself, it certainly would have done more than has been apparent here in the legislative history.
You don't think the Fifth Amendment applies to Congress?
I don't think so, sir.
You don't?
I don't think so, sir.
Does any part of the Constitution apply to the Congress?
May I say this, sir? The Fifth Amendment would apply to Congress insofar as the House can discipline its own members. I submit that separation of powers principles would prohibit the judiciary from applying the Fifth Amendment against members of Congress in these employment situations. But Congress is not immune from its own House discipline. And, of course, it's the members of Congress are not immune from voters deciding that a given individual should be replaced and another given individual should be elected. This moves me really...
Why shouldn't the speech or debate clause take care of all of your concerns in this regard?
Well, Your Honor, we believe it does. We believe that...
Well, I know, but suppose we disagreed with you on that, but of course there is an area to which this speech or debate clause applies, and that why wouldn't that, whatever area that is, why wouldn't that be an adequate answer to your separation of powers argument?
Are you saying the speech and debate clause and the separation of powers principles are the same, basically?
Well, it certainly would protect, the speech or debate clause certainly protects Congress against invasions by either the...
Exactly right, Your Honor. And this, again, is another special factor in this case, which is a most unusual case, I believe, in this case, which counsels hesitation in the implication of a Fifth Amendment cause of action. Because,
and suppose, counsel, that there's a federal statute that I thought was preventing me from engaging in some activities, and the federal government was threatening to enforce it against me. At least there was a case of controversy. And I went into a federal court and filed a complaint saying, asking for a declaratory judgment that the statute was unconstitutional under the Fifth Amendment, either the Due Process Clause or the Equal Protection Component. Now, where would I get my cause of action to do that, or would I have one?
I think you'd have a cause of action to do that.
Under the Fifth Amendment?
Yes.
To declare
a statute.
Well, but where did I get my cause of action? Isn't that a direct action under the Fifth Amendment?
Well, I believe it would be, sir. Yeah.
And you think that one would lie all right?
I think that one would lie all right, but I think that you get into separation of power situations here, that even if the court were to expand Bivens to other Fifth Amendment actions, is what I'm saying, that in this case, separation of power considerations prohibit the expansion.
Well, yes, but in my example, there would be no federal statute that extended the cause of action to me to sue the executive branch, and yet you say I could go into the court and have the court enjoin the executive branch.
Well, I may have misunderstood your question, Your Honor, but if the classification principle enunciated here is the correct principle involved in the case,
well,
there would be no individual
point.
Action.
That's a different point. That's a
well,
different point.
Who would the defendant be in my brother White's hypothetical case?
The people enforcing the statute.
Well, Your Honor, I do want to get into the speech and debate clause right, considerations here, if I may. We consider that the legislative personal assistants, the personal staff employees of members of Congress are, and the relationship between Congress and these personal employees are within the legitimate sphere of legislative activity. The aides of congressmen and congresswomen assist them in speech writing. They assist them in preparing for and discussing how to vote. They counsel them on how to vote. They help them introduce material at committee hearings. They review transcripts of committee hearings. And they really truly are involved in various stages of legislative decision making. In the Gravel case, the importance of legislative personal staffs was recognized. The court said that it is impossible for a modern-day legislator to perform legislative tasks without aides and assistants. It went so far as to say that the day-to-day work of the legislative staff was so critical to the legislative performance that the staff members are alter egos of the members of Congress. In Gravel, it was found that the aide even shared the immunity of Senator Gravel. We submit that the personal staffs of congressmen, really like the personal staffs of the judges, are selected for the purpose of assisting the legislator in performing the legislative task. That when the legislator interviews an individual or considers whether to retain an individual for employment, what he's really asking is, how can this person help me perform my legislative role? It's a careful decision because the person that is selected to be on the legislative staff may share that legislator's speech and debate immunity. That person may be immune as the third person. Yes, sir.
I know it's war over the dam, but it's always worried me. And just frankly, when the speech and debate clause was adopted, how many people do you think our founding fathers intended that to apply to?
Well,
numerically.
Numerically, at that time, that the legislators did not have the immense staffs that they have today. I would assume that's correct. I think they rode on a horse to Congress. No, but the Constitution does develop.
And that day up until now, there's been quite a lot of work.
That's right, you know. But of course, the aides and the personal assistants of the legislators have themselves been found to share this immunity. And so the employees of the congressmen must be considered in the speech and debate clause situation, regardless of what the original makeup and functioning of Congress was at that time, anyway. But again, the basic question that the legislator asks when he hires one of these individuals is, how can this person help me perform my legislative function? And therefore, we submit that the personal staffs of congressmen are assembled. They're brought together in a very broad legislative context. Which context should be immune? It should be immune from scrutiny by this court. It's not immune from scrutiny by the houses themselves, and it's not immune from the voters. I want to examine with you the effects of not conferring speech and debate immunity in this case, and the effects of not considering the separation of powers. We will have time-consuming, very burdensome lawsuits that will be inflicted on congressmen. They'll be involved in extensive discovery procedures. That this case alone is 4.5 years old. We feel that if congressmen are made to answer before the judiciary, before their personnel decisions, that it's going to have a chilling effect on their personnel decisions, that congressmen will be forced to retain incompetent aides when they would wish they can get rid of them, but they're scared to for fear of lawsuits.
Well, there are some congressmen here who think otherwise. At least they filed an amicus brief on the other side.
That's true, Your Honor, but we feel that their interests really are concerned more on the fair employment practices aspects of the societal problems today than they are on the true separation of power problems, which I think is the core of this, if you understand me there. If this cause of action is permitted and a speech and debate clause immunity doesn't apply, we're going to have lawsuits over congressmen's refusal to hire, the discharge of employees, the failure to promote, the failure to grant wage increases. There may be hundreds of applicants. We aren't talking about a few discharges out there. We're talking about hundreds of applicants who desire to work on the staffs of congressmen. The employment decisions that will be potentially judiciable and which over which causes of actions would be created would be an immense number, because this isn't like the Pentagon Papers episode or the or criminal situation. They aren't spatial events. These are very everyday employment decisions that occur in Congress. And for this reason, we feel that would be a very improper injection of this court into the judicial process. It would mean that the members of Congress would have to get familiar with statistical experts, industrial psychologists. They'll have to worry about class actions. Every congressman's going to need a personnel expert and a labor lawyer to operate. We feel that this would impair the integrity of the legislative process and would be both an unwarranted invasion of the principle of separation of powers and a restrictive view of the speech and debate immunity. That's all I have, gentlemen, unless there are questions. Thank you very much.
Very well, Mr. Gere. I think your time is entirely expired, Ms. Stasel. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.